Hey, this is Channing.
And this is Leah.
And you've reached Vessel, Art as a Doorway.
Welcome to episode 37. In this episode, it's really interesting how it happened. It was very serendipitous. We were in Wynwood Walls in Miami, and we happened to run into this amazing artist that a lot of people know about, and he's very interesting, and he was so gracious enough to let us interview him. His name is Peter Tunney.
Yeah, it was so cool getting a chance to meet Peter and look at his studio and really get an understanding on his practice and what he's done over the years. But before we get started with this interview, Leah, you've been doing something exciting. Could you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing over the past couple of months?
Sure. So I was invited to be part of New Ink, which is the first museum-led incubator for art, design, and technology founded by the New Museum in 2014.
Yeah, it is so cool, guys. Now, when you think about the New Museum, a lot of people, when we tell them about this, it's so hilarious. Some people say, well, what is the New Museum? Is that the name of the New Museum? New Ink? What is that all about? Leah, could you tell us a little bit more about this?
Of course. So the New Museum is the only museum in Manhattan, New York, devoted exclusively to contemporary art. And is really interesting because a lot of the people that they have or they curate at the New Museum in their program are people who blend technology, science, all kinds of interesting experimental ideas and materials to create interesting viewpoints, interesting artworks. In fact, they're also connected to Rhizome, which is a leading arts organization dedicated to digital-born art and culture. And I think Rhizome is exclusively online, but they partner with the New Museum in their programming.
Right. And from what I gather, Leah, correct me if I'm wrong, there's about five different tracks, and you were selected to be in the extended realities track, which is the XR track, correct?
Yes. Yeah, so the XR track blends traditional media. So it encompasses sculpture. It can encompass virtual reality, augmented reality. They have gamers that are also, or people who develop gaming that are in the track with me as well. So it metaverses. So it's really interesting. It kind of is like that blend of digital and physical realities all in one. So I'm super excited. It's been an incredible experience thus far, and I can't wait for you guys to see what me and the other artists do, and also even just learn about this program in general. Like, what some of these people are doing is phenomenal. I can't really wait to talk to you more about it.
Yeah, and we cannot wait to tell you about some of the exciting, immersive experiences that Leah is going to create. And fortunately, I have the privilege, well, I have the honor to actually be with her when we actually get some of these things up and running. So more to come. Stay tuned, please. This is a really big, exciting time for Leah in her career. And I think as listeners, I think you're really going to enjoy and you're going to really love some of the new creations that she's going to produce. So please stay tuned with that. But now we want to get back into this interview that we had with Peter Tunney.
So Peter Tunney is a neopop artist, and he works with language and text. He creates these amazing large-scaled paintings that are, they kind of look like paintings, but then when you get close, you're not sure what they're made of. It's like he has all these tiny little pieces of paper collaged, working together to create new imagery and using the contrast to create messages. And some of the messages that he talked to us about in this interview deals with gratitude. And there's a reason why. Gratitude sounds so basic and non-monumental, but when you hear his life's story, or you hear his story and the things that he went through, some of the decisions that he made, and the reason why he talks about gratitude in the way it does, it, you won't forget it, I promise.
So let's listen in to this interview with Peter Tunney. So we have the privileged audience to be here with Peter Tunney, and we're with his show here in the Wynnewood's Arts District.
We're in the Wynnewood Walls.
Wynnewood Walls.
This studio, my gallery, is in the Wynnewood Walls.
Excuse me, we're in the Wynnewood Walls. I stand corrected. But this is a beautiful show, audience. Leah and I, we came in, and we saw some of these beautiful chandeliers, and it's breathtaking. It's really difficult to put it into words, but we also see some of this beautiful artwork on the walls. Peter Tunney is an artist from the old school, but we want to get into actually how he came into art. We talked a little bit earlier about you having a brain injury, and that actually made your artwork even better. Peter, could you tell us a little bit about that?
I was kind of joking about that, but I have been hit in the head a few times really hard, and I am a better artist. I'm not sure that's a direct link,
okay.
But that is a sequence of events. I've been hammered, baby, and I'm better than ever. That's my show, Never Better. So did the 600-pound tree that smashed into my face knock me out? Did that help me? I think it did. I think it did. You'll have a hard time proving it, but you have a harder time disproving it, because here I am.
Peter, can I just ask, how did you get into this area, into Wynnewood? What was the decision-making in coming here?
I'd love to tell you I did this all by design, and I'm a genius. You know, it's not the way it happened. I'm an idiot. You know, I knew this guy, Tony Goldman. I loved him. He's a legend. He and his son kind of brought me here. We stood right outside this door, and Tony told me, you know, I'm going to build the Lower East Side for Miami kid. They need it. I'm going to give you the best building in the place. I need you to bring energy and sunshine. Are you in? Kind of as fast as I said it to you. We didn't have like 10 meetings before that. And we were standing up there. I was like, well, I don't really know what you're talking about, Tony. He said, listen, you got to come in here and hold it down. And I said, I don't know. He said, do you trust me? He said, I do. He said, then you're in. I said, okay, I'm in. I didn't know what I was even agreeing to. So I came in this room and there was nothing here. It was just me and the hood. And the next 13 years is history. What I did do is show up every day, been sober every day, worked hard every day, a lot of challenges, ups and downs, really difficult personal life situations I've been confronted with, some really dark nights, a few panic attacks, nothing to do with this place. My life, my people, my ecosystem. I have a lot of people in my ecosystem. You know, if Ethan, who is sitting over there, is going through some heavy in his life, it's probably going to come into my life. I'm going to process that somehow. You know, so I have a lot of stuff. Happy to help if I can, and happy to stay out if I can. But that's what happened. I just came here, just been putting my little piece of paper together, helping anyone who can, supporting these artists, doing what I could do, and here we are now.
And now Peter begins to describe to us his process of collage making and art making, where he takes magazines, articles, just many found objects sometimes and pictures, and cuts them up into small bits of paper.
Now tell us a little bit about the show Never Better. Now, how could you become even better than you are?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure how I did it, but I did it. I was just thinking about it as I was making these paintings. I've spent about 25,000 hours making word paintings. I love in your intro you said it's hard to put it into words, but I guess I have, haven't I? I put it into words. So I spent 25,000 hours making word paintings according to Malcolm Gladwell. I'm an expert. And what I realized is these paintings, these very paintings right behind you, are actually my very best things I've ever made. Now, it's true, maybe my mother likes what I made when I was 5 years old because that has sentimental value. But that doesn't mean I was a better artist. It doesn't mean my craft was better. It doesn't mean that I'm happier about the outcome. It doesn't mean that the amount of work and time I put into it. You know, if you and I became bricklayers tomorrow, we had to go lay a sidewalk, our first one ever, take you quite a long time. It wouldn't be perfectly smooth. You ever see like a good Italian bricklayer bang out a walkway or do cement? I mean, they just do it, right? So there is something to expertise and time, right? That gives you speed and efficiency and all these things. And so I have those things for doing this. What is my speed and efficiency at? Gluing tiny little pieces of paper together that somehow make my brain feel it's correct. There is a rationale. It's not random. I am thinking. In fact, I spend all of my creative time really just living between a couple of pieces of paper. Should I underlap it? Overlap it? In fact, there is an answer. Just like there's an answer to every chess situation you're in. You could ask the computer, what's the right move? Right? So there is an answer, because the white piece of paper, if it goes on the other white piece of paper, I don't get a very dynamic edge. If I put it under, it's no good. If I tear it, it's still white. I'll burn it. I'll burn the edge of this matchbook, then put it over. Oh, I like that scene. That's how that is made. So one reason I'm never better is really fully mental and has to do with my brain, because, say, 25 years ago, when I'm on a drug bender, I don't have the meditative quality to put these things together over and over. So for all of those reasons, and let alone from the micro to the macro, what am I doing? What are the pieces of paper? Where did they come from? How did I keep track of 100,000 little headlines for 30 years and then suddenly decide to put them together in that particular organization, and then on top of it, in fact, put the words never better? Because I realized this is the best I've ever been at doing it. It's not a braggadocious thing to say. You know, there is something known as the peach theory of an artist. You know what that is?
No.
That's, you put an unripe peach on the windowsill, it will absorb sunlight energy until it becomes perfectly ripe. The second after it becomes perfectly ripe, the chart goes down and it starts to rot. This is the chart. Many people have used that theory to describe an artist or a songwriter or whatever that you're having your moment, where all the stars are aligning. I'm happy. I'm healthy. I can see. I do have the little bits of paper. Oh, my, didn't get destroyed in a hurricane. You know, 1,000 things that have to line up for you to sit here with me today and be interested to talk to me.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm never better. And if I live another day, I'll probably be better tomorrow. But what's better? What's really better? If we get down to it, if you want to get down to it, there's only one thing you really are, is mentally better. Right? And mental is spiritual. So I don't say mentally and spiritually better. Mentally is spiritually. In fact, mentally is everything.
And now Peter begins to describe to us what it was like before he became sober, what it was like living with a drug-induced mental illness.
Right?
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
I used to think the CIA was in my toilet. They weren't. But I believed it. And I sweated.
Yeah.
And I was afraid. And I duct taped it shut. Okay. That's another mental condition. Probably not the best day of my life. Like, I would have told you it's the best I've ever been. But with hindsight, from where I sit today, that was not a good day, mentally or otherwise. That's not a good day. So today, for whatever reason, and listen, I've been dead, killed, come back to life. I've been so knocked around in this little broken body. here I am. Let me tell you what the main wheel of your mental wellness is. It's being grateful. See, because I haven't gotten beyond that yet. You might make an argument, actually, Peter, grateful is not where it's at. It's breathing, you know, or so you could have your story. Now, listen. But in my final analysis, after being on this earth for over 60 years and also interacting with just an inordinate amount of people, right? Like, I probably shook hands with 8,000 people in the last 48 hours. I've been doing that for 30 years. Just, it's a crazy construct of a huge amount of people coming into my world that I allow. In all of that, in spending years in and out of the hospital, watching other patients, just all of the observations, and I have a pretty clear memory, amazingly, of all of it. It would be like if you were in the hospital, which I was, and a kid came in, pediatrics, three beds in my room. I was in the same position in my bed for 8 months in pediatrics. So when you do that, you probably see 400 or 500 patients. I haven't really done the math, but it's hundreds of patients, right? So I was a smart kid. You learn how to diagnose what's going on. I saw a lot of head injury. I know a kid, he jumped over his front sprinkler. He hit his forehead on the lawn, knocked him out cold. Regained consciousness. Everything seemed normal. The parents, being very smart, took him to the hospital. You have a little kid with a head injury, you go out, you must go to the hospital. You must go to the hospital. A lot of people don't know that. And if you have a head injury and you're in a hospital setting, when they check your vitals every 4 hours, there's an additional protocol for head injury, which is a list of questions that they wrote down. Then they probably do it on a tablet now. Say, what is your name? Where are you from? What's your phone number? Why are you here? Right? There's a battery of questions. And I get chills just telling this story. It's one of the spookiest stories of my life. And your times are generally, I don't know if it's all hospitals, but it's kind of 12, 4 a.m., 8 a.m., because those go with shifts, right? You don't do it at 2:30 and 5. It works out. So at the 4 a.m. check, where you're groggy, you know, I do it so much, you just put out your arm, they do your thing, you go back to sleep. I hear them asking him the question, do you know where you are? And he said, I'm right here. She said, but where is here? He said, I'm right here. I am right here. And he started talking like a baby. And all he said was, I am right here. I'm right here. And his speech degraded. And they rushed him down and he died. And the parents, the mayhem in the hallway, in the room, and so from hitting your head on the lawn like that, right? In the hospital, you would see people, let's say a kid, a kind of a, not common, but something I saw a few of, maybe you lost a piece of your limb, water skiing, summertime accident, chainsaw or something, or had a serious injury. In my case, because I had a lot of injuries, what was said in my case, which I said too, was, thank God I didn't hit my head. Believe me, after you're in the hospital for a while, I don't care what you have, if you lost both your legs, you say, thank God I didn't hit my head, to our point of mental everything, right? You want to lose your arm or your brain, it's a no-brainer, right? No pun intended. And so you found people that would say, well, thank God it was his left arm, he writes with his right. That's what you really do say, by the way. Thank God it was below the knee. Thank God we didn't lose her head. Thank God it missed her heart. I mean, there's 1,000 of them. The people that say, thank God, and we're so lucky, they get better. That's what I saw. That's what I've seen in my life. So that's really, you know, you take that through till today, and the hundreds of thousands of people I've seen, the number one metric that I have for you being okay is if you're grateful. If you're on the pity pot all the time, if you're a victim in every situation, I know what that is. That is on the spectrum of mental illness, definitely addiction, right? Those things will occur in every kind of spectrum of addiction that you could think of, from bulimia, cutting, whatever it might be. And in general, people that don't suffer from that or any other mental illness, if you're believing and expressing, I'm so grateful. You know, my dad died. I had him for 54 years. Oh, I'm so grateful. I never thought, my dad did die in my arms, and I did have him 54 years. And I think I happened to be with my brothers. We were in a hospice, and I was listening to his breathing, and that was it. He went, so I always thought that when my dad died, That would be the worst moment of my life. I'd throw the TV out the window, go get drunk, crash the car. It's the kind of stuff I processed, you know. And I didn't grow up in that. I have no reason to think that, but that's how I was. But when my dad died, I said to my two brothers, we got to be so grateful. We had this man loving us every day of our life for 50 years. A lot of people don't even have a dad, let alone know their dad or have a very bad dad. A lot of bad dads out there. These two loving parents. I was grateful. I was surprised I said that. Why would you be grateful when your dad dies? Well, for good reason. Because he loved you even when you didn't deserve it. For example, one of a thousand. And so this idea of gratitude in your core, and I always use two T's because it is an attitude. It's not an event. This old guy said to me, and he died shortly after he told me this, he said, Peter, gratitude is not what you say when you get what you want. Gratitude is what you have left when nothing goes your way. And I love that. And I love the idea also that gratitude is a verb. I mean, all these people, I mean, I've been putting gratitude out there for about 20-something years, right? I've seen the Gratitude Magazine, Oprah's Gratitude Magazine, and that word has come out into our society now in a big way. Then I started doing Fear Less. I saw a TV show, a book, a lot. I'm not saying it's from me, but I definitely put it. I have billboards up that say gratitude. In my first 44 years of life, curiously, I don't think I ever uttered that word once.
Wow.
In my whole life. Like, I've been thinking about that these last few months. Like, when I was 17, did I say, wow, I'm so grateful? No. What I said was, I can't believe I only got this. You should have done that. Wow. I only used the word gratitude once I got sober. I learned it in there, and then it came up, and now I'm like, that's the whole thing. In other words, I can strip it away for you. If you're sitting here and you said, I'm just so grateful to be here on earth, I'm comfortable in my own skin. Welcome to paradise, baby. There's nothing else. There's no higher rank than being grateful. You don't get grateful times two. You're not more grateful than me for your baby or my baby. You either grateful or you ain't. That's how it is. And so to me, that's the wheel inside this mental condition and the wheel that heals the malady, you know, of being pissed off and ungrateful and everything. Dude, I deal with people that have spent 20, 30, 40 years incarcerated for crimes they did not commit. Right. At an Innocence Project dinner, I think there was 23 guys on stage. They all spoke for a couple minutes. And I think they did, I think it was 670 years they did between them. They committed no crimes. It's a lot of time, baby. It's a lot of time. And I would say every one of them used the word grateful or gratitude in their first 30 seconds of their speech. Said to this one guy, I could call him out, but I don't want to. It's his life. He got out in April, did 34 years. I met him in May at this dinner. And I went up to him, he knows who I was or something. I had an art piece there, it's a gratitude. He shook my hand and pulled me in. He said, you think you're Mr. Gratitude, Mr. Peter Tunney? No, sir, that's me. I am Mr. Gratitude. I'm the world champion of gratitude. I said, bro, you just did 34 years in max for a crime you didn't commit. You've been out for 2 months. I've been flying around, overdosing, but waking up. That's all, I overdosed, but I just happened to wake up. Not everyone woke up, I woke up. What is that, I'm a genius? That's called grace of God, right? So I said, you got to tell me, you know. I told him about my life and lifestyle. So you tell me how you could possibly be more grateful than me. Said something to the effect of, well, Mr. City Slicker, that's what he called me. He said, you know what you didn't have? Do you have hundreds of people, total strangers, loving you, caring about you, religiously, until they got you out of that hellhole? Because I had that, and for that I'm pretty grateful. Be still my little heart. He's your man. He should have 300 million followers. He's your guy. He's your hero. He has the answers to the tests. So I started off with, and this is both innocent and guilty, people that have come out of prison, that, you know, I started off thinking like, wow, you know, these guys, they had such a bad run, we should really take care of them. It's like feeling sorry for them. That's not the trade at all. They're our teachers. We had one guy, on March 10th, he got out. He came to our place, the Sunny Center, I think on March 13th, it was something like that. And a few days later, he got the stay-at-home order for COVID. Oh, I was like, we were talking about it here. I was like, the poor guy. He just got out. Now he gets a stay-at-home order. He must be crushed. You know? I called him up. I said, Paul, how you doing? I said, oh, Peter, God is so good. He slowed the whole world down for me. I wasn't ready for full speed. And you feel that because he never had a key to anything. That's what he told me. Nothing. Never went to the bathroom by himself for 34 years. Four-time surgery, cancer survivor in jail. He's got a flat screen, a sofa, a lazy boy, a white picket fence, a garden, a barbecue, pickup truck, a door on the bathroom. Dude, he could do 100 years like that, just walking around his property. And so I was pitching a story then. These guys, when everyone is whining because quarantine is so tough. By the way, on our subject, quarantine is not so physically tough. It's mentally tough. That is true. You know, when you're grandmother, you can't go in the nursing home, you have your hand up on the glass. That's mentally tough. You don't know how to handle it. You want to jump through the window, unless you're grateful just to see her. And it's all like that. It's all like that. And, you know, I'm not happy about everything every second. My dog died. It was really sad. I'm not thrilled about that. But that's not really touching my core fireball sun that never goes out of gratitude. Because the thing I do say and believe and feel about my dog is, I had that dog 14 years, the best dog you could ever have in your life. I never even knew a dog could be like that. What a blessing. What, my dog should live to 100? You know, like there's something called reality, right? And I said that to my kids, because they were very sad about the dog. I said, you know, if we all live to 100, you'll have 10 dogs. That's how it's gonna be. And by the way, if you live to 100, which I would like to, all your friends will be dead. All your dogs will have died. Is that sad? Or are you good to be 100? She's like, you can't have it both ways. And so somewhere in there is this, you know, that sun is just burning every day, right? It never gets out of power. It's pretty crazy when you think about it. Go light a fire outside, biggest bonfire you want, right here in the middle of the Wynnewood Walls. How long is that going to burn for? Chicago Fire went out 100 years ago. I mean, they all go out. Billion of them that you could see, just fireball, just enough to get you a little bit tan, warm you up from the beach, but not cook you. It's a very minor temperature degree for the sun, you know. So I'm grateful for the sun. The sun makes everything. Just wait till it gets dark and the sun doesn't come out, the whole thing goes away. The whole thing goes away. So at the core of all of it, like in trying to help other people and being in service, my real goal, I don't say it to them, is like to help them find their gratitude. See, because they have it. It's in there. You got to tune into it. And that's like behavioral modification therapy. That's like CBT. There's a lot. Meditation can help you find your gratitude. You have to calm your mind down. You don't have to float and say namaste. You have to calm your mind down consciously. You can breathe through your situational situation and come out the other side realizing I'm pretty lucky. Everyone who walked in this room today is lucky. And that's the beauty of the human condition. We're so super focused and sensationalize bad behavior and mental illness. We put mentally ill people in jail all the time. Like I would say 2 million out of 2.5 million is on the spectrum of something. 80% of them committed their crimes under the influence of something. That's mental illness. 28,000 gun homicides. It's a number people throw around. Like, that's a lot. Then you had about 4,000 gangs and some other stuff. About 1,000 people at school shootings and all that horrible stuff. But that's what we're focused on. Got to stop that school shooting. Well, I got more news for you. The school shooting is a mental health problem. And you could call that a lack of gratitude problem.
And as we continue our conversation with Peter, he begins to talk about an experience, that conversation he had with a father who had been greatly impacted by a mass shooting, and how he turned that negative experience that he and his family dealt with and the loss they had, and how they turned it into a situation where they could go around and help other people, other schools, other children, so they wouldn't have to deal with, hopefully, the same thing.
Those two kids in Columbine, I mean, you know, their story is they were kind of the goth kids, the bullied kids, the tortured kids. They lost their mind. The guy whose daughter, I forget his name, but she was shot in the back running down the hallway on film at Columbine. He's been out there the whole time. 20 years, I guess, now, right? And I listened to him speak once. And his thing is, he goes into schools. This is really all he does. This is how he thought about, what should I do to honor my daughter? I don't want this to happen to other people's kids, right? You really don't want that to happen to other people's kids, right? And that's your way of finding gratitude, is through service, right? Like, that's another whole podcast. But he goes to these schools, and I'm probably, you know, chopping it up badly, but it was kind of like, he would get an auditorium of kids together, show them the video of his daughter being shot, said, I'm the father, that's my daughter running down a hallway just like your school. Do you want this to happen in your school? No, we don't. Who here would like to help me on the task force? 50 kids would raise their hand. He'd take them into another group. They're volunteers. It's like self-selection, right? And he would say, here's what I want you to do. You break up in teams of four. You go find the 10 loneliest, neediest kids in this school and bring them into your friend group. That's what he wants them to do. He's had zero incidents of violence in every school he's been to for 20 years. Well, let me tell you why. Because that's the answer. That is the answer. It's not metal detectors. It's that. And the flip side of that is those kids are torturing these other kids and the parents are cheering them on. Someone's got to drop the hammer on that. That is no good. And listen, this is serious business. All these kids aren't the worst kids in the world, you know? How about, you know, you've got to have a loving intervention in there. You must. But you may not know that in the school. He might be the kid who can't pay attention. What's wrong with us? Why can't we see all these things? It's unconscionable. It's unconscionable because we're not tuned into that. We're not tuned into that. And that's all mental. That's mental. That's low self-esteem. That's no gratitude. And it's, for the most part, it's largely fixable. Here I am. I'm the proof. So it may not be every case, right? And it could even be a low success rate business. I don't care. But do the business. Maybe you save 1 out of 10. What difference does it make? We got to be in the business of that. You have to be in the business of taking the bullied kid into your friend group. That should be on the tip of every single parent's tongue. Unfortunately, you know what the parents are saying. You know, that kid deserves it. This, he's that, he's black, he's Chinese. It's on the news. They defend it.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. We're grateful to have you now in our life. Wow, that was a pretty interesting conversation, Leah, that we had with Peter.
Yeah, I can't believe he was willing to just sit down with us unexpectedly. Like, yeah, I'm really glad we walked in there that day, and I'm really happy that he was so happy talking to us and willing to share all of those gems.
Yeah, there was a couple of things that I really gathered from the conversation that we had with him, especially when we talked about the part on gratitude and how we can tune into gratitude. I really enjoyed hearing Peter start up when he spoke about his interaction or his friendship with Tony Goldman. But one of the things that Peter discussed was the fact that he created the work, but he also showed up every day. And no doubt that really contributed towards the success that he's had in his career.
And it was also really interesting in his experience seeing how the domino effect of paint, little bits of paper like he was talking about, and how it can turn into something bigger and move others and be a seed for good conversations. All of the people that we met there, his assistant was really, really cool, really nice. He had an impact on our life, and hopefully we had a little small impact on his.
Yeah, no doubt. And hopefully this has an impact on your life as you're listening into this conversation. But we really want to thank you because you've given us a bit of your time today. Thank you so much for listening in to Vessel, Art as a Doorway.